afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine for the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today, I'll be talking about hearts in San Francisco with Kim Meredith, CEO of the San Francisco General Hospital Foundation, and 2021 heart artist Jennifer Bloomer. Also, a conversation with composer Jake Heggie. In his role as creator of a podcast series of conversations with American opera singers called Sing Louder. Appropriately, for the beginning of Black History Month, we'll broadcast his podcast with the gifted mezzo-soprano Janae Bridges. Also happens to be Rosa Parks' birthday today. Plus, Peter Robinson talks with dramaturge Philippa Kelly about the goings-on at Cal Shakes in Orinda. Stay with us. Yes, Joanne, time to cue the music. Not that music. The immortal Peggy Lee singing You Gotta Have Heart from the Damn Yankees in that peppy Latin-flavored arrangement. An appropriate tune to introduce our first segment. Have you seen those large three-dimensional hearts in various parts of the city, each one the same size but uniquely painted and decorated? Well, some 17 years and 480 hearts later, Hearts in San Francisco artworks combined with Hearts events proceeds have raised more than $32 million to the San Francisco General Hospital Foundation to support important patient care at the hospital. Since 2004, with the Hearts being one of the most widely recognized public arts projects around the world, they're put on display across the city of San Francisco and beyond, from plazas, parks, and street corners to Union Square and the lobbies of corporate supporters throughout the state. Next Thursday, appropriately close to Valentine's Day, you're invited to a free virtual event from 6 to 7 p.m., Hearts in San Francisco, or Hearts in SF. That will feature appearances, among others, by Santana, Tony Bennett, and Bob Weir. A discussion with Dr. Robert Rodriguez, a San Francisco General Hospital emergency room doctor and member of the Biden-Harris Transition COVID-19 Advisory Board. Also the hospital's CEO, Dr. Susan Ehrlich, various civic leaders, a performance by Kim Nally Band, all emceed by the voice of the San Francisco Giants, Ronnell Brooks Moon. and much more. Did I mention it's free? Well, among the much more will be the San Francisco General Hospital Foundation CEO, Kim Meredith, who joins me now, along with one of the this year's heart artists, Jennifer Bloomer. Welcome, Kim. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you for having us here today. Great job, David. That was a wonderful overview.
Oh, thanks. Well, I hope you have more to say about it. I'm sure you do. Kim, you are the newly appointed CEO, relatively new, of the foundation as of May of last year, coming to us from Stanford's Center for Philanthropy and Civil Society, Stanford PACS, where you were the inaugural executive director. And I should also mention that you're an alumnus of Stanford as well, with a BA in economics. This is a heck of a time to get on board a healthcare organization.
There is no better time than in the middle of a pandemic to join a healthcare organization that in particular is supporting public health and health equity and care for all. Certainly what we learned throughout the summer, well, last spring and in the summer, is those who were most vulnerable were those who were suffering the most from the pandemic. So it's truly an honor to take sort of my background from corporate America, also had 12 years in public health before Stanford for 11 years. So to pull it all together to support the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital.
Fantastic. Well, this year's event is honoring three different programs that focus on health equity to better serve our city. Why don't you tell us about those three organizations?
Absolutely. So on February 11th from 6 to 7 p.m., you can join us and see the wonderful program that will be a compelling quick hour. And three of the programs that we'll be featuring include one, Solid Start, which really features the maternal health of low-income and homeless families, women, and their children, and the programs and the support needed for 0 to 4 for early childhood development that we know has such important impact in the longer-term journey of these children. We'll also be looking at the Richard Fine People's Clinic, where those with chronic illness, those without health care other than through public health, and the homeless population in San Francisco can come for ongoing care. So we'll have both patient stories and physician and nurse stories from that program additionally. And then there is the program that brings heart health and wellness education into the Bayview Clinic area. And some of you may remember last year an event where barbershop chairs were set out and reaching out into the Black African American community. So we'll be featuring those three programs and the essential workers and the patients who have benefited.
Fantastic. Now, some of the money raised for the foundation is through the auction of these specially created hearts. Tell us how it's decided what gets to be displayed and what is auctioned.
Absolutely. So the way it works, we put out every year we commission these hearts. And this year we had over 200 artists put their names in, and soon you will hear from Jen Bloom. So it was a very competitive process to get to the 22 where we are today. We selected 6 life-size hearts, which really represent, those are the ones that are in Union Square that you can take a socially distanced walk and go see today. And they represent what has been going on this year, a Black Lives Matter heart, a mass heart, you know, capturing the colors from the fire, people looking at the stars. They're just magnificent this year. And then you go into the tabletop and the minis, which are in the flood building right down the street in the window display. So they will all be there through the event next week, and individuals can bid on these hearts. And then our sponsors, actually, if you're over a $25,000 sponsor, you get a tabletop or a mini of your choice. If you're a $50,000 sponsor, you get a life size or a tabletop of your choice. And then anybody can bid on them. So absolutely, they are available now.
Right. Go to heartsinsf.org to learn more about the event and about the hearts that are available. Once again, 22 new heart sculptures are in the series. 6 large hearts, 6 tabletop, and 10 minis, designed by 23 Bay Area-based artists, both established and upcoming. Speaking of which, Jennifer Blumer is founder of the Radici Studios here in San Francisco and has created and taught art in Colorado, Guatemala, India, Italy, Kenya, Thailand, and Eritrea before settling down in our fair city some 12 years ago. Jennifer, once again, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you were chosen for creating one of the six large hearts to join the pantheon of hearts, some of which have been made as mosaics with mixed media, acrylics, even Swarovski crystal. So tell us about your choice of materials and your theme, Together Under the Stars.
Yeah, so I worked on my concept this summer when we were many months already into the COVID pandemic and Black Lives Matter protests were coming along, and I'm an artist and activist. As you mentioned, I run Radici Studios. And so when I sat down to create my design, I just spent some time thinking about how, you know, we're all living these individual lives with our individual problems and challenges, and so impacted by the pandemic, but impacted so differently. And yet, you know, the bigger picture, what brings us together is our common humanity. And so I had this vision of people from so many different backgrounds kind of encircling the heart and looking up at a sky full of stars, and just our ability as humans to feel the awe of the bigger, you know, the bigger world above us, and be able to kind of share that.
Terrific. And it looks beautiful. I saw a little thumbnail sketch of it that's part of the press release. Tell me, first of all, how were you selected to become involved in the program?
Well, so as a San Francisco resident, I've seen the hearts around, was so excited to be selected. This summer, I was actually working on another project in conjunction with the San Francisco Hospital Foundation, painting a mural as part of Paint the Void, where we're painting the boarded up storefronts and windows, and actually painted a mural along a Zuni restaurant in downtown San Francisco. So got to work with a bunch of ER doctors from the San Francisco General to paint that mural together in community. And as I was working on that mural, I started chatting and hearing about the arts or the hearts. That the hearts application was due soon, and spoke to another heart artist, and got really inspired by the design she was showing me. So it got me excited about the project.
Fantastic. Once again, talking with Jennifer Blumer, one of the Hearts in SF designer creators, and with Kim Meredith, the CEO of the San Francisco Hospital Foundation. Kim, the event on the 11th sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun, and I did mention it, and I'll mention it again. It is free. You're encouraged to register in advance to learn more information at heartsinsf.org. So tell me, what else is the foundation working on beyond this Hearts project?
Well, absolutely. Let me just add a little bit about that evening. We will have live Dr. Robert Rodriguez, who you had mentioned was part of the Biden-Harris COVID transition task force team. And we will be getting the most updated information about the vaccination and vaccine distribution, which I think is really important for everyone to be able to hear directly. It has been such a, you know, kind of highs and lows with 48-hour notice to the general hospital and to other providers in the recent month. So things seem to be smoothing out, and I think there'll be a sense of optimism as we can hear how are we going to get 100 million vaccinations out in the first 100 days. So I really want to reinforce that message that I hope everyone will join to hear that because it's very important. Some of what we've been involved in dovetails with that. We raised $5 million for a COVID fund this year. We've supported PPE testing. We've supported telehealth, a large $2 million initiative for the general to be reaching out to the patients in the community who would be better served through telehealth rather than coming into the general. We've supported over a $400,000 equity initiative, again, supporting those in the community most in need through the general. 15% of the population in San Francisco is from the Latinx community, but 50% of the cases are from that community, and 75% of the COVID cases at the general come from that community. So investing in telehealth, investing in equity work for the essential workers and for the patients has been vital to what we've been doing this year. And so we are really grateful for our sponsors who've underwritten this event so we can share that information and news with the entire community. And I'd also like to share, this is brand new, our friends at Bank of America will generously match up to $50,000 for anyone who makes a gift between Monday, February 8th through Valentine's Day, Sunday, February 14th. So I wanted to throw that in because that's big news for us.
Terrific. Again, more information at heartsinsf.org. The virtual event free on February 11th, a week from today, from 6 to 7 p.m. Jennifer, what will ultimately become of your heart? Do we know yet?
Well, hopefully some amazing supporter will bid on it and get to take it home or into a public location. You know as much as I do at this point, but we're hoping to get folks excited about it.
Nice. Well, congratulations on being selected for such a well-loved and recognized public art project. Artist Jennifer Bloom. Kim Meredith, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
HeartsInSF.org. Check it out. We got to hear it. This from Jimmy Fallon's Tonight Show appearance in 2016. At the ripe, spry age of 90, here is the one and only
Tony Bennett.
I left my heart in San Francisco, high on a hill, it calls to me to be where little cable cars climb halfway to the stars.
From the great Tony Bennett's 2016 Tonight Show appearance, 90 years old then, now a few years older than that, and sadly diagnosed with Alzheimer's. It's just been announced. So we hope that he can conquer or bear with that as much as we can, because he is still a creative force in our lives, and happy to hear him. Still to come, Peter Robinson talks with Cal Shakes dramaturge about what's shaking there, along with a discussion of what audiences might have been like in the days of the Bard. But next, always a pleasure to welcome composer and the local treasure, Jake Heggie, who's admired around the world for operas such as Dead Man Walking and Moby Dick, a friend to singers of all types. This time to talk about his new foray into the world of podcasting and interviewing called Singing Louder. Welcome back, Jake.
Thanks. Great to be with you, David, always.
Well,
that was so inspiring about the hearts, too. I think we should do a project where composers who are inspired by the hearts, we create a whole program of music inspired by the hearts around San Francisco. That would be fun. You heard it here first.
All right. Kim's smiling. I think she's going to be in touch with you about that one.
Okay.
So anyway, what are you trying to do? Take my job away? Your own podcast with an interview and a cheeky title at that called...
Sing Louder.
Sing Louder now.
Yeah.
Is that an admonition or a word of encouragement to rally your subjects?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I grew up in a time when opera singers were on TV regularly. They were on the Muppet. Marilyn Horn was on the Muppets. Beverly Sills hosted the Tonight Show. Your job is safe, David. you know, you saw these people everywhere, and you learned about them. They were in popular culture and on the stage, and that has slipped away over the past few decades. And I work closely with singers. I love them. Their stories are so fascinating. They are such brave people, and their journey to take on the responsibility and the discipline of being an opera singer today, travel all over the world, in and out, quickly, here and there. I think it's so fascinating. And I just was looking for an opportunity to put them front and center again. And I happened to be having a conversation about this with a good friend, Bob Ellis, and he agreed to be executive producer. And then we got associated with the conservatory. And then we found our producer, Emily Shaw, and it sort of went from there. And I just started calling on my friends, and they all said, yes, let's do it. And when we started, it was pre-COVID with Sasha Cook. And then all of a sudden, everything fell apart, and we thought we're never going to be able to do this. And then, you know, we started learning about technology. So we did interviews with people. One of them was in Vienna. A couple were in Texas. A couple were in the Midwest. You know, it was really quite an amazing experience.
Well, I can't think of anyone better to do a series like this. These are people you know personally and have written music for in many cases. And you delve not only into the art of singing and performance, but also get to your subject's human side. For instance, I understand that when we broadcast the Sasha Cook, Diva Sasha Cook's not so diva-like vomiting during a performance.
A poor thing. They've been so honest and open, but it's so human, you know, because in addition to doing the superhuman thing, you're still a human being on the stage. And she was in Houston performing the Verdi Requiem and literally got sick while she was on stage performing in front of 3,000 people opening night and had to run off stage. There was no cover for her. And get cleaned up as best as possible and run back out and then continue singing. And her father said to her afterwards, I've never been prouder of you because you didn't stop. You kept going. And I think these stories are inspiring. And the range of stories that the obstacles people have to overcome, it's really amazing to take on the discipline and the choice of being an opera singer in this day and age. Remarkable.
In these conversations, you're not just featuring a best of vocal clip. We're going to get to hear some vocal warm-ups as well, huh?
Yeah. Everyone was very, very generous. I thought, you know, we only hear the finished product, usually on a recording or on the stage, but there's a lot of steps to getting there, including just warming up, keeping the voice alive and active and energized. Mm-hmm. And so just wanted to include all of those. And everyone told stories about their tough times as well as their triumphs. And Sing Louder, the title applies not only to the way they sing, but their personalities and also what they have to say, because it really is about finding your voice. And everyone can relate to that, I think. And whether you find your voice as a radio host, as an artist, you know, doing projects for the betterment of humanity through health, welfare, education, or as an opera singer, everyone has a voice. They have something to say. And when you find that, you just have to do it as loud as possible. And mm-hmm. so that there's a double meaning to Sing Louder.
Right. Well, we're very excited to partner with you on this in a certain way. And in fact, I think we've talked about making the first open air of each month a feature of Jake Heggy podcasts.
Well, that would be great. I would love it. Thank you.
And appropriately for the start of Black History Month, the wonderful mezzo-soprano Janae Bridges, who I had the pleasure to talk with when she was featured here at the San Francisco Opera for her company debut in André Chénier back in 2016. So mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to your take on having her on a one-on-one. Thanks again, Jake.
Just have a conversation and let the person talk. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Jake. Here is the premiere episode for KLW of Sing Louder, featuring Jake Heggy today with Janae Bridges.
Imagine finding your voice in an opera house. Welcome to Sing Louder, where great artists talk about the high wire act of life as an opera singer. I'm your host, composer Jake Heggy. This episode features my June conversation with mezzo-soprano Janae Bridges. Janae is a true rising star. The New York Times has featured her 3 times in the past year. Last fall, she made her highly acclaimed Metropolitan Opera debut as Nefertiti in the hit production of Philip Glass's Akhenaten. And this past spring, she bowed as Dalila in the Washington National Opera's production of Sanson et Dalila at the Kennedy Center in D.C. Janae and I spoke while she was sheltering in place in Houston, Texas. Her spring, summer, and fall season engagements had been canceled, and protests against police brutality toward African Americans were sweeping the nation and world. We spoke about the basketball game that defined her commitment to singing and the power she's found in her voice to wake people up, both on and off the opera stage. Let's talk a little bit about your background. How did you find and begin singing opera?
I was a senior in high school when I had to take one more arts elective in order to graduate. So I joined the choir. My teacher, Miss Julie Kangas, said, "You really have a natural gift. Your voice really lends itself to singing classically." My world was just completely opened up. This new way of singing really evoked feelings that I'd never felt before, and a joy and a comfort.
But you were also kind of a sports girl at the time,
right?
I was,
yeah. I long story short, I was kind of forced to choose by my basketball coach at the time. I was in my first opera at Tacoma Opera, the Chorus of Tosca. And a very important game was the same night that would get us to the next round of the championships. He allowed me to do the rehearsal in the day, then have my mom drive me up north for the game, just as long as I was in time to warm up with my team. So I finished the rehearsal, got up to the game, suited up in my gear, and he sat me on the bench. He told me he couldn't guarantee that I would play for the rest of the season. So I said, "I can guarantee you that I'm done."
Wow.
So I walked out of the stadium, and it was very dramatic. From that moment on is really when I started to seriously focus on classical singing. I scurried and I got together an audition CD and sent it out to conservatories, and Manhattan School of Music ended up biting.
And so you had your choir teacher on one hand and your coach on the other, and your coach gave you an ultimatum, essentially, yeah?
Essentially.
Was there music in your house growing up, or was it an athletic family primarily, or?
I grew up with my parents playing Motown every morning. And that because I'm from Washington State, it's often gray and rainy. And so that Motown just got us into a mood, got us awake and going to go to school, because it was difficult some days to wake up, you know, to grayness.
After you left high school, you got into the Manhattan School, is that right?
Yes, Manhattan School of Music.
Yeah. That was a big shift from Tacoma to New York City, studying voice and learning about opera.
Huge. Coming from a small town on the West Coast and going to the big city, the Big Apple, mm-hmm. It was huge. I mean, I was shocked in every way imaginable, but I was so excited and welcoming of the shock, I guess you mm-hmm. can say.
Yeah.
And so as a student, I really didn't have any money. And yeah. Going to the Met and these different performance venues were very expensive. However, I made it happen because that's just my personality.
Yeah.
So I would ask my parents for $20 here and there, or, you know, I did a work study job and would save my money so I could sit in the nosebleed seats and mm-hmm. stand in the line to get the rush tickets. So I was there. I was taking it all in.
Was there a particular production that suddenly blew your mind, like suddenly made you think, wow, I really, really want to do this now?
Yes, actually, in 2008, I'll never forget, I saw Zalame, and I just remember being so transfixed by the production. And also, it was the first time that I saw an African-American performing on stage. And that was Morris Robinson, who is a bass. And I just remember being so inspired by him mm-hmm. and the sound and his presence and the fact that he was Black. It just really spoke to me differently. In that moment, it was like, wow, this is so amazing. And I really want to do this. Like, I really want to make it happen.
Let's listen to some of the recordings you sent and talk a little bit about them. So I put Die Nachtigall first. You're a young artist, but it's so glorious and so beautiful. It's from the 7 early songs of Berg. And it was for the competition in Cardiff, yes?
Yeah. That was in 2015 when I competed in the BBC Cardiff Singer of the World competition. And I chose Die Nachtigall because it resonates with me so much. First of all, it just sits really well in my voice. Mm-hmm. And actually, Jesse Norman was the first recording of that I ever heard. And so I just thought, I want her to be with me in this in this really special moment.
Yeah.
And also just the meaning of the song, The Nightingale. I find myself able to work really best at night, just when it's quiet and I'm all alone. And I remember feeling very confident, actually. I had very little nervous energy. I had nerves, but they weren't debilitating. I just felt like I am supposed to be here. When I was actually an undergrad at Manhattan School of Music, I didn't study as a voice type. And I'm so grateful to my teachers for that. I really sang everything. You know, the 24 Italian songs, I sang them in the low key, in the middle key, in the high key. And it was just so, I didn't know what I was doing. I was so green. I just sang what felt good. And that's what I was led to do by my teachers because my range was rather large.
Yeah.
It's been a journey for me because when I used to sing auditions and do competitions, there was always at least one judge or adjudicator that would question whether I was really a mezzo.
Yeah.
So for me, it's always kind of been this journey of, well, I'm just going to sing what feels good.
Yeah.
And I hope people will come along with me.
So another recording you picked is Oh Glory in this very special arrangement.
Yes.
Was this arrangement made for you or?
It was. This arrangement was made by my dear friend, Sean Opeblo. And he just knows how to make my voice come alive through specifically writing spirituals. This song, it shows many things. It shows my range, but it also, I feel like you can feel me through this song. Mm. As artists, I truly believe that we are vessels to bringing art alive, to bringing humanity, and to also helping people to feel.
Do spirituals, does that repertoire have a special place in your life and history and your singing life?
Yes, absolutely. Spirituals have a very special place. I grew up singing in the church choir.
Mm-hmm.
And the denomination that I grew up with is AME, African Methodist Episcopal. And we sing a lot of hymns and spirituals. I feel like I'm able to sing spirituals in a way that is just really most authentic to who I am.
Mm.
And I've actually thought about, can I sing opera the way I sing spirituals? And I would like to. I'm just not sure.
I feel like you bring that energy when you sing, though. I mean, there's something very luminous about the way you sing, something from deep within.
Wow. Thank you.
And to me, that it comes from that connection, that very deep connection that you have to who you are personally.
Hmm. Thank you.
Hey, so another talent you've been discovering is you recently hosted this amazing panel for LA Opera, where you moderated a discussion with five other great African-American opera singers about issues in the business relating to race. And that was brand new for you, right?
Brand new.
Yeah.
It was my first panel ever that I've moderated, and it was a scary thing, you know, putting myself out there in that way for the first time in front of thousands of people was a little overwhelming.
And yet you walk on the stage in Akhenaten so confident and so gorgeously, but this was what made you nervous. That's so
this
funny.
This made me more nervous than singing any role on any size stage. I will tell you that. The topic was, it was a little scary for me to address.
Yeah. And this is the issue of race and racism in
yes.
the opera business and opera world.
Absolutely. I didn't know if it was going to be received well. I didn't know if this was going to be the end of my career. but I'm grateful because it's been received very well. And it's done the opposite, actually. Many companies have reached out to me wanting to explore this more and wanting to change, which was the goal, and to take action and to dismantle racism.
It's a different way of waking people up.
Absolutely. I mean,
it's like, it's what you do as a creative artist, but you have that power as an individual.
Yes. You know, I know that I hold that power. And for me, it is essential that I don't keep it for myself, you know. I feel like it is my duty to expand people in any way possible
mm-hmm.
as an artist, but also as an ambassador for not only art, not only opera, but for humanity.
So you gave us one more little musical excerpt, and it's an a cappella version of Sweet Little Jesus Boy that was recorded at a Christmas concert. Does that song have special meaning to you?
Yes. Well, having grown up in the Black church, this was one of the spirituals that we sang. And it's home for me. You know, the words say, "Didn't know you'd come to save us, to take our sins away. And we're sorry for the way that we've treated you. We didn't know who you were." It's also just a parallel to how we treat each other as humans, you know. And I think that this, and this time especially, it's very poignant. But I can come back to Sweet Little Jesus Boy, and it centers me, it grounds me to be better. Just to be better, to be good. And I like singing it a cappella because there's nothing to distract me.
Yeah.
You know, it's the voice. It's the connection to the deepest parts of my soul.
Save us, Lord, to take take our sins away.
You're still a young woman with a big career, but there are younger ones coming along who are suddenly facing this very strange time in the world, transformative time in the world. Do you have any words of advice that you would give them?
You said transformative, and I think that is a key word because we're in a time now where I think that we can create whatever we want. So what I would say to young aspiring singers is, be creative. Don't put yourself in a box and do all that you can to aim to perfect your craft so that when we do come to some sense of normalcy, you're ready. Because if you have the goods, but you're not ready, it can pass you by, you know?
Right.
Also, just staying encouraged. Talk to people that encourage you and inspire you. Watch things that inspire you. And give yourself grace. It's okay to feel bad one day or 1 hour, 1 minute, whatever. Because we're not in a normal time. But I think if you can find inspiration through whatever you're feeling,
yeah,
you'll be okay. It's okay to be angry, but keep the hope through the anger. Stay hopeful through that.
Janae, thank you so much for joining us and sharing so deeply and so openly your journey to finding your voice and sharing that voice on the biggest stages of the world. Can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Wow. Thank you, Jake. This has been so lovely to talk specifically about the voice. Thank you.
That was mezzo-soprano Janae Bridges. I love how Janae brings the passion of the spirituals from her childhood to the international opera stage. She finds joy in singing what feels good and purpose in waking people up. You can listen to Janae's music and find out more at JanaeBridgesMezzo.com. You can also follow her on Instagram at Janae B. Mezzo. Sing Louder is produced by Emily Shaw. Remote recording assistance and mixing by Sarah McCarthy. Additional recording by George S. Rosenthal at the Complex Recording Studio. Our executive producer is Bob Ellis. This episode included In Order, Some Times of Day by Jake Heggie, Mon Coeur Souvra Ta Voix from Saint-Saëns et Dalila by Camille Saint-Saëns, recorded at WCRB's On the Rise event, honoring their 10th anniversary as part of WGBH. Die Nachtigall from Sieben Frühe Lieder by Alban Berg, from the BBC Cardiff Singer of the World competition in 2015, led by Thomas Sondergaard. O Glory, arranged by Sean Ocpeblo, with Paul Sanchez at the piano. Sweet Little Jesus Boy by Robert McGimsey from the 2018 WQXR Christmas Concert at the Green Space. And Cinder by Jonathan Barlow. You can find more details about the music featured in this episode in our show notes, as well as a link to the Los Angeles Opera's Lift Every Voice panel discussion. If you know someone who might enjoy this podcast, please spread the word. Until next time, I'm Jake Heggie. Thanks for listening.
And thanks to Jake Heggie for that wonderful new podcast, Sing Louder, which we're going to be happy to feature once a month as part of our open air. He's a natural and a true San Francisco treasure. So that's a natural way to talk to these wonderful singers. Happy to feature Sing Louder in the months ahead and wish him a happy new podcasting career. To round things out today, here's Peter Robinson in conversation with the always enchanting Philippa Kelly, dramaturge at Cal Shakes and partner of good friend and composer Paul Drescher, to discuss what was an audience like in Shakespeare's day compared to the modern day. We should be hearing, coincidentally, a time of plague. Plus, they'll share some new books on the life of the bard. Welcome, my dear, dear Philippa.
Hello, David.
And please. And Peter, take it away.
Yeah, okay.
Peter, you muted yourself again.
So. Yeah, I'm okay. Am I okay? Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Hi, Philippa. Good. Welcome to the studio here at KLW. And just for listeners who may not have heard Philippa before, she is the dramaturge at Cal Shakes. She's also author of 6 different books relating to dramaturgy and Shakespeare, and currently teaching a course at UC Berkeley. So welcome, Philippa. Good to have you with us. And tell us, what is happening at Cal Shakes this summer?
Hello, Peter, and thank you and David for having me on. So this summer, we've got quite a bit happening. We did the Ellen McLaughlin Oresteia in January, and that's available for anybody who wants to. It was a play reading, and it was wonderful. Just email me if you want to, or Calshake if you want to see that and listen. And then I'm doing a series of 50-minute lectures in the early evenings. You can pour yourself a glass of wine and go with me on a journey of one play every 2 weeks. And I really enjoy doing that. We did it last year as well. And you can, as I say, pour yourself a glass of wine, and I might do that as well. And then we have we are actually staging The Winter's Tale, directed by Eric Ting, in our beautiful open air space in the summer. So we're excited about that, and we're just beginning to plan that right now. And
good. Yeah. And the Winter's Tale is one of Shakespeare's last plays, written around about 1610, 1611. And I often think that he was reviewing his own life in The Tempest and in The Winter's Tale, because it really deals with forgiveness. What is your feeling about that?
Yes, I think it's an intriguing play. It's one of his beautiful plays. It's called a romance, but it has a lot in it that looks as if it's hurtling toward a tragedy for the first, before intermission, the first couple of acts, first 3 acts. And I always think of, I might be misquoting her, but just Martha Nussbaum, the philosopher, who said, to respond with compassion, I must be willing to encounter the thought that this suffering person might be me. And so in Winter's Tale, we see a repellent king who just races into fury when he begins to imagine that his wife might have slept with his best friend. And everything just, descends so rapidly into her being held on a cold prison floor to give birth. And one thinks, wow, this guy really rivals Lear for being a repellent father and king. And how can we actually feel anything for such a character, somebody driven by his own demons of jealousy to lash out at those who, in loving him, are most vulnerable? And that's why I think I always come back in my thoughts to this Martha Nussbaum quote about compassion. But Shakespeare in this play, quite differently to his others, unlocks our emotion for this anti-hero by giving the key to the play's 2 strong women, Hermione, his wife, and Paulina, her servant. they have a secret plan for endurance, as many, many women have had to keep their own survival secret over the centuries. And in emerging after 16 long years with forgiveness and hope, and I think you're right on the button there, Peter, they bring miracles. But the miracle that I most love is not something that comes from above, but it's the simple capacity to forgive and to believe that we, human beings, are capable of new life, just like you can see a little plant shrivel.
Yeah, and if I can just deal with what you're saying about Hermione, is that she is essentially off stage for a great period of time. I mean, in terms of the character goes missing. So I think from a staging point of view, how do you anticipate we may be dealing with that type of question?
Well, people will have to see the production to get a handle on that when we've worked it out ourselves, how we want to stage it. But what I will say is that her disappearance enables the play to move in its location. And so we have this incredible new birth of a love between her daughter and Leontes' daughter and the son of their friend Polixenes, which could never happen if the two older ones were still center stage.
Now, you mentioned King Lear, because in a sense it's a play about vengeance and then forgiveness. The two things come together. So we're dealing in what you can call a romantic tragedy come happy ending. I think, is that a summation that works?
Well, I think yes, and the sense that that happy ending is not going to come through winning $1 million or anything from outside. Essentially, it can only happen from ourselves, from within. And when I was mentioning before about the little plant shriveled, that plant with a little bit of water or love can bloom again, and that's a miracle.
Now, we've been living, as we all know here in America through the plague. And, of course, Shakespeare was more than familiar with the whole concept of plague. In fact, the theatres closed in the mid-1590s. And I think about suffering in terms of The Winter's Tale, but I also think of Shakespeare and suffering. How would you compare a Shakespearean audience to today's audience?
In the physicality of the audience, his plays, every afternoon that they were performed, they'd go on at 2 o'clock, and the theatre would hold 2,000 people. So when you think of entertainments, we have so many options today, and we can really stay encapsulated in our bubbles. But in Shakespeare's day, there was really theatre, sermons, bear baiting or cockfighting. So the theatre was incredibly important, and you could go for as little as a penny. And so it was very affordable for people. People would have to pee where they stood because you couldn't get out, and you could buy food from vendors, and you would leave when there was still plenty of light left because the plays were performed in the summer. In times of the plague, of course, the theatres were shut down, which gave Shakespeare the chance to write so much of his beautiful body of sonnets.
Well, I should add that people who are maybe not familiar with Cowshakes, they have a beautiful outdoor setting in Arinda, so it's outdoor in the summertime. And just one tip, at the beginning of each play, Philippa does a wonderful address just to take you through it. And I think part of your work as a dramaturge is bringing the backstage through the footlights to the front stage. So the dramaturge really is hands-on for everybody. Is that your job?
I'd like to think so. And also, a dramaturge is a mixture between a scholar who is really happy behind a humongous pile of books and somebody who loves to in a sense, create a deep well with that scholarship from which you draw, and you're not going to draw everything. You may only draw a little bit. You have to gauge your rehearsal room, and when you're speaking to audiences, gauge the audience to see what you can bring out that can enrich and expand this experience for people. And so that's why I give a slightly different Grove talk each night as I work out how where this audience is and what they might like to listen to. And I'm not the only person who gives the Grove talks. We've got a wonderful team. And so, yes, that's the work of a dramaturg is very broad, and certain dramaturgs prefer certain things to others. I love both scholarship and actually talking with actors, which I will often do at 2 o'clock in the morning by email, and with members of the audience. And as I mentioned, if anybody wants to join this In-Depth with Philippa Kelly, I'm doing a course every Tuesday evening, 5:30 p.m., beginning, I think, in late February.
And I should add that Philippa is also something of a mind reader. You know, later in the year at the Marin Philosophical Society, she's going to be talking about what do Shakespearean characters think. So you have to get inside the head of the producer, the head of the director, the head of the actors, the head of the audience, and tell us what they think. Are you a mind reader?
Well, one thing about theatre, it's a little bit like you go out, say, to the store, you go wherever you can go, which is limited right now, and we speak to other people and we come back, and what we receive is never identical to what that speaker intended. And that's why we have so many misunderstandings and fights. And that's the thing with Shakespeare. He is obsessed with not the faults in what we say so much as in mishearing what we ought to understand.
Well, the Winter's Tale, in fact, is a tale for the summer. It may be a winter's tale, but in fact it is happening this summer at Cowshakes. And again, I want to thank you, Philippa, for giving us these insights and once again bringing the human voice of Shakespeare across these wavelengths here at KLW. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. And you and David always make such a beautiful home for me to be able to do that on KLW. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Philippa. That's open air for this week. A reminder, too, that the San Francisco Symphony and music director Esa-Pekka Salonen today released the Soundbox Nostalgia, launching the SF Symphony's new on-demand video streaming service, SF Symphony Plus, and kicking off the symphony's new digital Soundbox series. Curated and conducted by music director Esa-Pekka Salonen and featuring performances by San Francisco Symphony musicians, the program will feature chamber works composed in the last decade, including Freya Whaley Cohen's Conjure, Missy Mazzulli's Vespers for violin, and Caroline Shaw's Entract. Soundbox Nostalgia, available now at sfsymphonyplus.org. A reminder that our shows at Open Air are archived at kalw.org. You can send me an email if you've got a show segment selection, so suggestion, david@kalw.org. Next week's show is going to depend on the trial of Donald J. Trump, which we will be carrying live through NPR. So if we do have a show, you'll be hearing about the South Bay Musical Theater with excerpts from their production of Pride and Prejudice, and what else is going on with South Bay Music Theater. And from San Francisco Ballet, we'll talk with dancer and choreographer Miles Thatcher, who's yet to be named ballet, premieres on Program 2, getting underway shortly at SF Ballet. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show, and to Joanne Marr for manning the controls while we are all remotely trying to balance the technical aspects of hosting remotely. Thank you, Joanne. Coming up next on KALW San Francisco, it's Bina from the San Francisco Jewish Community Center. Thanks again for listening.